You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we dive into the world of divas, what it means to be a prominent, powerful, usually female performer, and how that role has changed in recent years. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a mini radio drama that takes place in Madison just in time for Halloween.
Spooky tales around Halloween have made their way into listeners' ears across the country since almost the birth of radio. In the spirit of this long tradition, we bring you The Haunting of the Orpheum Theater. Here's WPR's A. Emily Ralph.
It's a Friday night in October, and I'm on an American Ghost Walks tour in downtown Madison. This isn't for work or anything, just a normal Friday, but it really got me thinking. With so many reportedly haunted theaters here, I wanted to know which one was the most haunted. Built in 1926, the Orpheum seemed to call out to me, so I arranged to pay a visit. Looking up at this place, there's a feeling of unexpected time travel. Like, if you step in the wrong spot, you'd suddenly find yourself back in the roaring 20s. I've been here before, of course. There's a strong deja vu. Gives me shivers. Anyway, time to go inside.
Hello? Hello?
Ah, yes, hello. You must be Emily. We've been expecting you. Let me show you around.
So excited to be- If the outside feels like time slipping, the inside is kind of overwhelming. I can almost see all the layers of moments here, stacked on top of each other like sedimentary rock. But instead of fossils, there are, of course, ghosts. Tonight, I'm hoping to find two of them, the original night manager and a head usher. I hear keys, but I can't see anything. I'll just put my gear down and fire up my spectral translator. Whoa. You are right there.
Oh, wait, you can see me?
Sure, I have this fancy deal I made.
Well, that's the cat's meow.
Thank you, I think so too. Okay, I have a few questions.
Why, certainly.
So you're the original night manager here?
I've always been the night manager.
So people know you for the sound of your keys. What's that about?
Well, you know, when you're bored and need to do something with your hands, and the noise is actually quite calming.
So interesting. Well, it was nice to meet you.
You too, Emily. Though, I think we'll be talking again pretty soon.
Hello? Hello? I hadn't read about any lady ghosts here. Okay, now let's see if we can find the usher. The legend is that he died falling from the balcony and spends all his time cleaning the floor where he fell. It's fascinating and horrifying, just the thought of being trapped in a loop like that, of doing the same thing over and over again forever. Ugh. Okay, I see a glow. Hello, are you the head usher?
I've always been the head usher.
Everyone keeps saying that. So my understanding is that you died here and just clean this spot every night? What's the deal with that?
Have you ever tried to get blood and popcorn oil out of a carpet?
Well, yes, once, actually.
So you know it's basically impossible.
Sure, but... Wait. Who is that? What's going on? What's going on?
Can you hear me?
And after three full nights, that's as close as our radio team got to communicating with her. It's amazing. Every night since her death in 1947, Emily has wandered the theater's halls with her recorder, always in pursuit of that one last story. For Wisconsin Public Radio, this has been Emily and the Haunting of the Orpheum Theater. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
WPR's senior spooky correspondent, A. Emily Ralph, produced that story just in time for Halloween. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Check out Wisconsin Life's Instagram page to catch a behind-the-scenes glimpse of the making of Emily and the Haunting of the Orpheum Theater. Now, who comes to mind when you hear the word diva? Do you think of that person, maybe that performer in a positive way, negative, a little bit of both? Our next guest has spent a lot of time thinking and writing about a particular kind of diva in the music, pop culture, and celebrity worlds. The Madonnas, Beyoncés, Taylor Swifts, and more, usually, but not always, women. He says the rules and roles of divas have changed over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who comes to your mind when we say the word diva? And are you a fan, a critic, a fan-a-me, a little of both? What gives a performer diva status? What questions do you have about the role of divas in our popular culture? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Spencer Kornhaber is a staff writer at The Atlantic where he covers music and popular culture. His new book is called On Divas, Persona, Pleasure, Power. Spencer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You don't nail down a hard and fast definition of diva, but you've got some guidelines. What is key to someone being definable anyway as a diva?
Right. Well, for most people, diva is sort of like a two-pronged word, right? It means, for most people, it just means female singer. But there's this other definition that has this connotation of being demanding and hard to deal with. And you know, just sort of like tough and self-involved. And obviously that definition sort of flows out of some stereotypes about the first definition, the female singer kind. So I would say, you know, as I looked around popular culture and saw this archetype showing up, not just with women, but with a lot of women, it made me think about what do we really mean when we say someone's a diva? And it comes down to a sort of a kind of assertiveness, a kind of pushing your voice, your identity, your desires out into the world in a way that disrupts the world, challenging social norms, challenging manners, and really kind of like cleaving the audience into groups that either love you or really, really don't like you.
If, say, a Midwestern public radio host started acting like a diva, well, I think everyone's going to see that as negative, right? But if somebody at a, I don't know, Beyonce or Madonna level or something like that, I think, as I read a lot of your essays, Spencer, there's a thought that it's okay because they are performing at such a high level that they get to be a diva.
Right, right. Nicki Minaj has this sort of somewhat famous spiel where she talks about being offered pickle juice on set and walking away like at some photo shoot. And she basically is saying, you know, I really put in a lot of work and thought into what I do. And the people who are working with me need to show me some respect, because otherwise I would just be drinking pickle juice. So it's sort of like this inspirational model of, asking for what you deserve.
And you wrote in a more recent piece in The Atlantic that, quote, divas are the most important entertainers of our time. Can you build on that a little?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look around at the pop music landscape, really the entertainment landscape of the moment, the names dominating it that come to mind are Taylor Swift and Beyonce. You know, Taylor Swift is not just a musician at this point. She's an entire business empire. She just became a billionaire. She has, she has one of the most viewed movies in America right now. We are turning to really, really powerful women to lead the culture right now. You know, we've always had these figures around, and they've often been very, very powerful and successful, but they haven't always centered their own dominance, their own leadership, their own like kind of like mogul capabilities in the way that the divas of our moment are.
Your opening chapter is about Britney Spears, who, since you wrote this piece, since the book came out, released her own book, memoir, looking back at her difficult career, difficult life. And it really, like, you think, okay, somebody in this diva position, making lots of money, presumably, in charge of their game. But in not just Britney Spears' case, in some cases, people are feeling manipulated, controlled at best. Can you talk about some of the double-edged sword here?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you look back on the history of pop divadom, at least, you really do see a lot of stories of these seemingly indomitable women being kind of dominated and controlled by men behind the scenes, whether that's their managers or significant others, or in Britney's case, family members. You have people like Whitney Houston or Tina Turner really, really facing stories of domestic violence. You have Mariah Carey, who was basically in a conservatorship de facto of her own in the 90s. You know, there are a lot of stories of popular women needing to really turn to the public and to their fans in order to be freed. And so Britney is maybe the most dramatic and certainly the most recent and vivid example of that. And, you know, a lot of the female pop stars that came up after her specifically to find themselves in opposition or in reaction to what Britney went through and has been going through, where it's very clear now that they are the bosses of their own career, or they really make that illusion, at least, central to their performance. But Britney was not able to do that in the early 2000s, you know, as she kind of evolved from girlhood to womanhood. She started to behave like a young adult woman does, started dating, drinking, you know, living her own life, spending her own money, and doing it all in the public eye at a time when the public eye was sharper and had more scrutiny towards celebrities than it ever had, thanks to the rise of the internet. And so she was sort of like in this perfect storm moment where just by asserting her own desires, she was facing backlash and judgment from all quarters. And eventually the people who were making money from her, the people around her who could exert some control, really started to exert some more control. And she found herself in a situation where she had basically lost the rights of an adult woman and was the ward of her father for 13 years, and has only recently attained freedom.
A theme that goes through your book and the different people you look for is, in many ways, who controls the identity of the diva? Is it the diva, her, or in some cases himself, their manager or controlling family members, as you talked about, the fans, celebrity journalism, the internet, when that starts coming along? How much tension is there between all of those?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the diva is that, you know, she is okay living in conflict. We, as the public, maybe enjoy seeing the diva resting like in a power struggle with the people around her, with her managers and these controlling male figures, but also with the media and with their fans and with public perceptions. You know, and the canny divas do seem to be able to pull the public onto their side, at least when they're at the peak of their powers. And in case after case, though, you do see these stories of downfall when the public turns and says, you know, you're demanding too much and you're not giving us enough. Your performance is starting to slip. And so that we afford you these capabilities and we can take them away too.
Talking to Spencer Kornhaber about his new book. It's called On Divas, Persona, Pleasure, Power. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's talk about the gender thing. Spencer, I keep saying mostly women, mostly not, and some men. But it seems like there's something about women in positions of power. You talk about this in a little of the book that that can latch on to this diva status, the pros and the cons. Whereas a guy in this position might not be judged as negatively for the negative side of divadom. Why is that?
Right. Well, in a lot of ways, right, like the term diva just refers to a woman acting the same impudence that a man does, or that certain kinds of men do, that boss, you know, bossy, powerful men kind of take for granted their ability to ask for what they want, to set the rules of engagement, to even speak with them. When women start to do that, you know, we're not used to it. And so we judge it more harshly. And, you know, that goes really far back. But, you know, the smart divas understand this and start working this double standard into their art. You know, Beyonce has a song saying the diva is a female version of a hustler. You know, Taylor Swift has that song, The Man, which is really about, you know, if I was a man, you would all say that I'm the man. You would all like treat me like this swaggering success rather than this, you know, troublemaker.
We're talking to Spencer Kornhaber about his new book, On Divas, Persona, Pleasure, Power. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of somebody you think fits this diva category, or do you have some ambivalent feelings about a, say, pop star in this diva zone? Join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you think about divas in this way, who is a diva? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Spencer Kornhaber from The Atlantic. We're talking about the role of the pop diva, how it's changed over the years, what it says about changes in our wider popular culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest about his work or if you have thoughts on divas or a particular pop culture big name celebrity who fits the category in your mind. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. One of the people in this diva category now is in the news, Lizzo, Spencer, and you highlight a parallel in a recent piece with a past, or I guess she's still around, a diva herself, Madonna, where they both had this persona of, you know, kind of wild. They had this inner circle of people. Things were pretty loosey-goosey sexually and things like that. Both of them getting ultimately sued by dancers and others in their circles. Can you talk about what you see in those stories?
Right, right. Lizzo's really facing some public relations and legal challenges lately because her dancers say that the environment on tour was just inappropriate. There were no boundaries. They were being kind of asked to go to strip clubs with their boss and, you know, forced into situations they didn't really want to be in. And when they spoke up, they felt intimidated. You know, it's a sort of shocking story, but it's also very familiar. If you watch Madonna's 1991 documentary, Truth or Dare, which is really a classic of the concert documentary genre, you see Madonna interacting with her dancers in ways that really kind of resemble the way that Lizzo is said to have done so. But Madonna, you know, though she had to settle with her dancers out of court, this was never really a public relations problem for her. She was, in fact, celebrated for being kind of like a high-handed, demanding, domineering figure. That's part of what we love about Madonna. It seems like we're moving into this era where what we want from our stars, our cultural leaders, and certainly the women in those roles, is this sort of contradictory blend of being sort of like bad and a rule breaker and a troublemaker, but also being like a really nice person and a really considerate boss. You know, kind of trying to reconcile some of the conversations we've had over the past few years, like following Me Too and maybe even Meme Too, the kind of reckoning over bossy behavior and abusive power dynamics. We are now turning to divas who never had to be accountable with how they used their power before, and asking them to maybe professionalize, maybe sharpen up, and maybe be a kinder, gentler kind of you know, cultural leader. It's sort of a tough ask, but it's a little bit of a hopeful one too, I think.
Talking to Spencer Kornhaber about his new book on divas, Persona, Pleasure, Power. Let's bring on a caller. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi, thanks very much. Is there a more historic past back look, say like Barbara Streisand, I would say, had to be the quintessential diva of her day. Did you have some sort of historic past search,
Kevin,
for this diva persona?
Thanks for the call. Spencer, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can trace this archetype back for more than a century. You know, it kind of comes out of opera and the prima donna concept. And certainly Barbara absolutely fits the bill, both like with her sort of stunning, you know, vocal abilities and ability to command the stage, but also with the kind of demands she has been known for making in her personal life. You know, a lot of those demands were about how she spends her money and uses her success, you know, the opulent ways that she has wanted to like decorate her homes. A lot of things she gets called a diva for are about how she's perceived, you know, like the angle from which I believe she wants to be photographed or things like that. You know, that's called diva behavior, and you can understand it seems kind of preposterous to a normal person, but her job is to, you know, be this vaunted goddess-like figure, so she's going to want to have some control over that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Kevin. Spencer, you look at modern social media, TikTok and others, where, in theory, we all have the opportunity to become celebrities and go viral. Are you seeing at least attempts to impersonate divas as people try to go viral on TikTok and elsewhere?
Yeah, TikTok is sort of democratizing the diva, I think. I think it's very common to sort of, you know, film videos in your living room, holding a hairbrush, acting like Beyonce and doing her 8-count choreo. And some people have gone viral doing that and then become a little bit of pop sensations themselves. And so there's like a way to kind of like cheat your way into feeling like a diva. You know, we're at a time though when platforms like TikTok also make it harder to attain the kind of spectacle and vast reach and kind of production values that we took for granted with the previous generations of divas. And so I'm kind of curious to see if we'll ever have anyone reach the kind of heights of spectacle and reach that someone like Beyonce or Whitney ever did.
And Spencer, as we wrap up, you're a music writer, but is there a diva musician who you turn to for fun listening when you just need something fun to listen to at the risk of offending the other divas, just briefly?
Well, you don't have to choose one, but if I had to, I am all in on Lady Gaga. She has been with me for a long time, and I think she's great and hilarious.
Spencer, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Spencer Kornhaber, staff writer for The Atlantic. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called On Divas, Persona, Pleasure, Power. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Republicans in the state legislature are working on a bill that would, in effect, punish college campuses accused of limiting free speech. We'll find out what's in the works and what kind of things it could change. And a lot of workplaces, especially offices, are loosening up their dress codes these days. We'll look at the new rules of what to wear at work. You can tell us what's going on in your workplace. You can get started right now. Actually, head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. That and more. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the FCC is looking to bring back net neutrality rules at the federal level for internet service providers. We'll talk to an internet law expert about what's happened since the regulations were repealed, what could change if they are reinstated. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The FCC is moving forward with plans to reinstate a set of regulations called net neutrality. The rules aim to prevent internet service providers from slowing or blocking some online services while prioritizing others. Their latest proposal would bring back many of the same net neutrality rules that were adopted back in 2015 under the Obama administration, but then repealed by the FCC under former President Trump. Current FCC Chair Jessica Rosenworcel announced the plan last month. The first draft of the proposal was approved by the FCC board earlier this month in a 3-2 party line vote.
So if your broadband provider mucks up your traffic, messes around with your ability to go where you want and do what you want online, you can't just pick up and take your business to another provider. That provider may be the only game in town. You need a referee on the field looking out for the public interest and ensuring that access is fast, open, and fair.
Republicans and telecoms groups have criticized net neutrality as regulatory overreach that they say is unnecessary. It's the latest in an ongoing debate over broadband oversight, and it raises questions about how the internet has operated with and without net neutrality. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want these net neutrality rules for internet providers back in place? Why or why not? Do you think the internet should be treated like a utility, or should it be left to an open market? What questions do you have about this long-running debate? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Christopher Terry is an associate professor of media ethics and law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. He's a Wisconsin native who's a graduate of UW-Oshkosh, UW-Milwaukee, and UW-Madison. Christopher, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me.
In basic terms, what is net neutrality?
Net neutrality is a term that was coined by Columbia professor Tim Wu to describe the regulation of network management practices. More simply, it covers three basic provisions, It prevents your internet service provider from blocking content it doesn't want you to have, reducing speed or access to content it might not want you to have a lot, or prioritizing its own content. So lots of cable companies that provide internet service also own media companies, and directing you to their content at a higher speed, which is called paid prioritization.
Since net neutrality was overturned under the Trump administration, do we know, have internet service providers been doing that stuff, slowing down or green lighting different online things, different websites, services?
Well, There's two things. Number one, net neutrality did not go away with the Trump administration under Ajit Pai at the FCC moving regulation back to Title I. What happened was is that you took away the federal regulation of that. And in the absence of that, many states, including most notably California, implemented their own net neutrality rules when the FCC stepped out of the way. So it's not correct. And there's a lot of discussion of this, that net neutrality wasn't necessary because it hasn't, nothing bad happened in the intervening years. But it's not true that net neutrality wasn't in place. It just wasn't in place at the federal level.
Is it possible for internet service providers not in one of those states to do these things, to slow down or speed up internet? Or is it such a, you know, global market that if they can't do it in California, they don't do it anywhere?
Well, there are 14, sometimes counted as 18 states that have a similar provision to California's. California's is the only one that was tested in court. That's why that one gets the most credit. But yes, your internet service provider can block you from any content it doesn't want you to have. And the idea that net neutrality, there's never been a need for it. It was actually blocking by Comcast that led to the initial legal dispute over net neutrality back in 2008 and 2009.
Can you talk a little bit about the arguments under the Trump administration and a Republican, then Republican-led FCC to get rid of FCC, get rid of net neutrality?
Well, what the agency did under the Trump administration is they moved regulation out of Title II and back to Title I. And what that means is that what the conservatives would call a light touch regulatory approach, there were some provisions that ISPs had to comply with. There was a transparency requirement. There was some disclosure requirements on when and how they would throttle content. But what's really different about what the Pai-led FCC did during the Trump administration is that the agency actually argued against a rule that was being upheld in court, and that would be the Title II rule that was passed under the Obama administration in 2015.
We are talking about net neutrality. Christopher Terry is with us from the University of Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this debate for years, over a decade, actually? You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Christopher, as I understand it, part of the core argument here is, you know, what is broadband? Is it an information service? Is it a telecommunication service? Is it a utility? Can you talk about some of these fundamental conceptual debates over how and if we regulate these?
Sure. Under Title II, which is what the FCC is trying to move back to with this latest action, broadband is treated as a common carrier. Common carrier, most easily understood by your audience, is probably the old school traditional on-the-wall phone line, where your internet service provider can make money by delivering content to and from you as the consumer, but really can't discriminate against the content that moves through that system. They can't make any decisions about what that content is, assuming that content is legal. Under Title I, which is the information service approach, the FCC more or less stays out of that equation. And what happens there is that the providers have more control over their own networks. And that gives them the ability to make decisions to block, throttle, or prioritize content.
If I'm an internet consumer with a service provider that does do this stuff, slows down this content over there that they're not making money on, speeds up this content that they do make money on, am I going to feel the difference? Am I going to notice it?
Very much so. In fact, about halfway through this process, after the second court case, which was Verizon's challenge to the FCC's second set of net neutrality rules, there was a short period of time after that decision where streaming services, like especially, but also including Netflix, were being throttled by providers, and it was noticeable at the time. If your content is being throttled, you will notice it very quickly.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was wondering what the guests' thoughts were on revisiting Section 230 of the Federal Communications Act in relation to liable by internet service providers about putting forth information that's potentially knowingly false, harmful, or dangerous, and what his thoughts are on. I am in favor of revisiting this issue. I think we've moved quickly, and it's time to revisit it.
Chris, thanks for the call. Christopher, as I understand it, Section 230 is a big internet law issue. Is it tangential to this net neutrality, or is there a stronger connection than I think?
Well, lots of people are trying to draw a connection between those two things, but they're not closely related. Section 230 is an element of the Telecommunications Act that protects platforms, by that I mean websites, for content that's posted by third parties. So in the caller's hypothetical, an internet service provider that is posting its own content that is defamatory and he said libel, but in defamatory terms. The internet service provider doesn't have any protection for that. What it does have protection is if you or the caller post something on Facebook, Twitter, I'm sorry, X, or what have you, that is defamatory. So if I defame you in some way, Rob, I commit libel against you online, the platform where I post that is not liable for the content that I post. And that's an entirely separate legal issue. I'd be happy to come on a different day to discuss in detail if you'd like.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Christopher, this net neutrality issue doesn't inherently seem like something that should be a Republican-Democratic debate. And yet, we have these party line votes of Democratic and Republican appointees moving it one way and then the other. Why has this become a partisan issue at the FCC and beyond?
Well, I don't really understand that, because the entire debate started during the Bush administration, when Michael Powell, who is now actually arguing against net neutrality rules in his position with the NCTA, but he was the one who advocated for the first set of net neutrality rules, which were called the Four Principles. And it's really very much become sort of a partisan issue, but I don't understand why. It's really a consumer protection issue at its core.
We're talking University of Minnesota media ethics and law professor Christopher Terry about net neutrality rules, what's happened since they were repealed at the federal level, what could change if they're brought back. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the net neutrality back and forth over the last bunch of years? What do you think? How do you feel about your internet service provider now? Do you have accessible high-speed internet where you are in the first place? Join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Christopher Terry, Associate Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota. We're talking to him about the internet regulations known as net neutrality. They were repealed at the federal level during the Trump administration. Now the FCC under President Biden is working to bring those regulations back. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about this idea of net neutrality? What questions do you have for our expert? Do you feel like you see that sometimes where something is faster online? Certain services say other things are slower than you might expect. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Christopher, I want to add another element in here, and we heard this from the FCC commissioner earlier. the idea that, in effect, for a lot of people, the market is not an answer to this problem. They may not, if they feel like their services are being throttled, they can't just move to another business. They might only have one or maybe two options.
Yes, that's a significant part of what Commissioner Rosenworcel is trying to put forward. I think one thing that never gets mentioned when it comes to net neutrality is that part of what goes on is we make a Title II reference as simple as net neutrality. What the FCC is trying to do this time is actually resolve some unresolved broadband regulatory issues, including the competition issue. There is not very much competition in places in the United States. In fact, in most places, you don't have two high-speed providers as options. You might have a high-speed and a close to high-speed, but in many places, there's only one, and in still a significant part of the United States, there's none. And that issue is tied back to the debate over net neutrality. When the FCC lost the ability to enforce net neutrality in the Comcast decision in 2010, it undermined the FCC's authority to implement the National Broadband Plan.
Did the Obama-era regulations on net neutrality fix or change that after that court ruling?
Well, for the short period of time they were in place, it did give the FCC some authority to move forward. But part of the issue that we see right now is the Biden administration has allocated quite a bit of money to resolve broadband gaps. And the FCC even has to wrestle with people that it's trying to give money to implement broadband because it doesn't have all of the necessary authority that it wants or probably could use. Under Title I, which is part of what the FCC is trying to do with the move back to Title II.
The FCC provisionally approved this 3-2 vote we mentioned earlier. These kind of federal regulations, they are not a one-step process. What would happen from now on to bring net neutrality back into place at the federal level?
Well, they haven't provisionally approved it. They approved the decision to decide whether or not they're actually going to do it.
Gotcha.
they are currently taking comments. The comment period extends into December. I don't know exactly what will happen if the government shuts down. But in early December, the FCC will take a first round of comments out of a docket, examine what those comments say. It may modify the rule at that point, and at some point, 60 to 90 days after that, it will propose a new rule, a new version of what it proposed a couple weeks ago. There'll be another round of comments, and then 60 to 90 days after that, we might see the final rule, which would then take another 60 to 90 days to implement.
The comment process itself has been controversial in the past. Under the Trump administration, FCC commissioners pointed toward a lot of comments against net neutrality. It emerged later that a lot of those weren't actual human people making those comments. Can you take us back to what we found out then?
Sure. Initially, with the Title II order in 2015, the FCC took in about 3.5 million comments, public comments. A lot of those were just sort of emails or whatever. A lot of it was driven by John Oliver's segment on net neutrality. When the FCC went to repeal the Title II order under the Trump administration, there was some astroturfing of comments. In fact, someone used my name and address to file a comment against net neutrality, as did for Mickey Mouse and all sorts of other types of people. There's some assessments that commenting scheme generated as many as 16 million comments, about two-thirds of which are just fake.
Talking to Christopher Terry, Associate Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota, talking about the years-long back and forth in net neutrality when it comes to broadband internet, the FCC moving to bring it back, early stages there. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Is there still action going on at the state level, Christopher? Are you seeing more states moving to join California and others with their own net neutrality rules?
There were several states that were looking at it, but I think they're kind of playing the wait and see game now, because the federal regulation, if it does go back on the books and survives the judicial review, would preempt the state law, including California's, ironically.
Now, here, of course, we're talking about the United States. What are we seeing the rest of the world do when it comes to issues of net neutrality?
Well, it depends on where you're talking about. European regulators are arguing over it. In the UK, they're having a significant debate over whether or not net neutrality should apply. Some countries, it's just sort of built into how their internet system works because they don't have quite as commercial of media system as we do here in the U.S.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, I was wondering how this future net neutrality law would affect me. For example, is I recently purchased the Hulu, Disney, ESPN bundle, but my carrier, Charter, won't let me get the ESPN unless I buy the upgrade TV app to play ESPN. But it's all, I'm paying for ones and zeros. What's the difference between the ones and zeros of Disney or Hulu and the ones and zeros of ESPN? I don't get why they're allowed to charge me extra for ones, other different ones and zeros.
Mike, thanks for the call. Christopher, does this tap into the net neutrality argument?
Yes, but also involves the a la carte cable argument. The short answer for the caller is that if there are provisions on the books that says your internet service provider cannot dictate any terms on which your content moves back and forth to you, as it could not under common carrier, it would not be able to charge you the extra part for that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. Now, Christopher, when net neutrality came into place, I think there were dire predictions that it would hurt the market, hurt the companies that provide internet services, ultimately hurt our services in the long run. When net neutrality was repealed, at least at the federal level, as you mentioned, it's still in place at the state level, arguments that this would be a disaster for the internet. I mean, are both sides over-exaggerating the impacts of going back and forth on this?
Yes, very much so. The chief argument for Title II that I think, and I'm a strong supporter of net neutrality in sort of in concept, is that it assesses one set of regulations that everyone in the telecommunications world clearly understands. It's a federal system. It's been around since the 1930s. Everybody understands what the rules are. There are some concerns about the rate regulations and stuff, and the FCC has provided some forbearance in this proposed set of rules for that. But this is an issue that, I mean, I think I said the day that the announcement was made, it was like a classic hit station of all the same old rhetoric has been put back out, because it very much has. And it's a very heated issue over a very nerdy regulatory position.
Now we see changes under a Democratic president reversed under a Republican, now maybe going back the other way. Is this a case where Congress ultimately could step in and say, okay, we're going to clarify what we want on this part of telecommunications regulation and put an end to the debate for a while?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think for all the finger pointing we have back and forth at the FCC, fingers should be pointed at Congress. The issue wasn't really well understood at the beginning of this debate, but after the Verizon decision, when the national broadband plan was basically derailed 21 days after it was launched, Congress should have gotten involved one way or the other and just provided clarity. Until Congress tells the FCC what to do, the FCC is, whether you agree with Title I or Title II, it is trying to apply old regulation to a system that it doesn't have a lot of guidance on what Congress wants it to do. As an administrative agency, the FCC can only really do what it's told, and it's trying to do that right now.
In our last few moments, Christopher, if people feel strongly about this, how do they get in touch with the FCC during this comment period?
The FCC's website has the electronic comment filing system. Do a search for the net neutrality docket, and you can easily file a comment there right online. It's a very simple form.
Christopher, thanks again for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
That's Christopher Terry, Associate Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. He's with us today for a look at why the FCC is looking to bring back net neutrality rules at the federal level, what it could mean for the way we use the internet. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org, or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.